And joining us right now is a familiar face. You've seen him on so many different TV shows and movies. Stephen Tobolowsky is with us. He has a hilarious DVD out. I'm telling you, I was laughing hysterically. And I didn't even get to watch the special features, another 90 minutes. I'll check that out another time. But Stephen Tobolowsky's Birthday Party is one of the funniest films I've ever seen. And he's a really funny guy, and he's got a plethora of experience. I want to talk about some of that and some of the little quirky things that have happened in your life. Stephen, welcome to PMP Network.
Well, thank you, Mark. Thank you.
How are you today?
I am doing great.
Good.
It's beautiful out here in California. Where are you at?
I'm in Boston.
Oh, my goodness. That's where my brother went to school.
Oh, really? Where did he go to school?
He went to medical school there and went to Massachusetts General Hospital to get his internship.
And where did he go to med school?
I don't know, one of those big places with a hospital nearby.
Did he go to Tufts or Harvard or BU or?
I think it was, Massachusetts? Boy, I can't.
Well, there's a UMass Medical Center.
Yeah, that's it.
In Worcester.
Yes.
Well, that's interesting. Now, you have quite a varied career here. It's amazing, actually, how far back it goes. Being such a young guy that you are.
Yeah, that's right.
But the first thing on your resume here on TV is actually an episode of Alice.
Yeah, way back when, Alice. I remember they had cast somebody else in that part. I played actually like a Wolfman Jack kind of DJ.
Caveman Carl.
Caveman Carl.
Yep.
And it was, you know, whoa, hello, you know, and it was one of those guys. And they had fired the guy who was originally playing it, and they brought me in like about 2 days before they shot the show, and it was the first TV show I did, and I invited all of my friends to the taping. To me, it was like I had crossed through the barrier. I actually got to meet Linda Lavin and be on the set. Oh, it was so exciting. Oh, that's a memory.
He did a couple soaps in a row, too. They did Knots Landing and Falcon Crest.
Yeah, I remember when I did that Falcon Crest show, the director had seen me in theater and had cast me from that, and I was playing the role of Doctor. You know, I didn't even have a name. I was just Doctor.
Mm.
Anyway, he asked me the night before the shoot, do you want to practice? Do you want to rehearse? Well, I had three lines. My name was Doctor. I said, no, sir, I'm fine. I'm A-okay. Next day I get on the set, and they go, ready and action. And we all stood there silently. And everyone was kind of smiling and nodding and looking at me, and they said, Stephen, I think it's your turn to talk. I go, oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Let's try that again. Ready and action. Pause, and I was going, you know, I don't have anything to say. I'm just Doctor. I just have three lines at the end of the scene. And the director turned pale and he said, you didn't get the rewrites? No. They give me the rewrites. I had three pages of medical lace jargon. I mean, I wish I had gone to Boston, you know, medical school. It was like, he has subdural hematoma and, you know, all that ER talk.
Uh-huh.
Three pages. And I was just, and we, I don't even know how we ended up shooting the scene that day. I just kind of made it up as we went and we survived. But all of us who were on that scene, Susan Sullivan and Robert Foxworth, whenever we see each other now on the streets, we kind of laugh at each other in memory of that moment.
Well, it's interesting to note that you also played a doctor on L.A. Law, on yes. Baby Talk, on Murder One. You've played a lot of doctors on Chicago Hope. You have that doctor look, I guess.
I got the doctor look. I could be the doctor and the patient. When I did L.A. Law, I was the doctor who was accused of malpractice because the baby died in the operating room mm-hmm. when the baby was born. And I remember I had some sort of speech in the stand. And after the TV show aired, I got something from the Miami newspaper saying that a judge, a real-life judge, declared a mistrial in this lawsuit against a doctor in Miami because of an L.A. Law episode in which the doctor was so sympathetically portrayed, it would prejudice a jury. So I thought, there I have made my mark on the legal world.
There you go. See, cited in a court document. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's even better than an Emmy.
Yeah.
You know, you also were in my favorite show of all time, Seinfeld, the heart attack episode. Tell me a little bit about that.
I was working on a movie at the time with some deaf actors, and I had to learn sign language of the deaf. And I hadn't really learned it yet, but I was taking courses in it, and Mark Hirschfeld, who now is like president of NBC, but back then he was a casting director. It was Jerry's first year on the air, and I went in for a meeting with Mark and Jerry Seinfeld, and they said, we have a part of this kind of new age healer. Can you think of any way to make it funny? And I thought back to my sign language of the deaf that I really hadn't kind of learned yet, but I was learning. I said, what happens if this guy, Tor, Kramer's buddy, only spoke in signals and signs and everything? And I did it for them, and they laughed, and they put me in the show, and we had a great time. That was quite a show. That was a lot of fun.
Every episode is memorable in Seinfeld.
Just terrific. Those guys are so funny.
Now, another show which recently went off the air after all these years was That 70s Show, where you played the professor in an episode with Laurie featured in that.
That was one of the few episodes where I got to actually kiss the girl and not go to jail for it. I played her lecherous professor who was going to run away with her. And the people who work on that show, like Mark Brazil, is the executive producer on that show. And I know people generally in TV land, you know, when you watch TV, you don't pay attention as to who the executive producers are. But basically, if Mark Brazil is an executive producer on the show, you can pretty much be assured it's going to be a quality show. You know, it comes from the top, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was so funny. They have great directors, great cast, you know. They're pretty much in charge of keeping the whole show together. So that was a ton of fun.
Well, a couple of shows, you've had multiple roles that have been recurring roles, like
yeah.
CSI Miami, where you did five episodes. That must be pretty good. In Deadwood, a few episodes on that. That must be a good thing to know that you're going to have some stuff coming in.
Yeah, I a lot of times when you do a recurring role, you feel a little bit like an ugly girl on Friday night. What happens is they call you up and they say, we want to alert you, you're going to be in next week's show. And so you get all excited and you're waiting for the script to come, and you turn down other work and you turn down other auditions, and then it gets to be that week and you're wondering where the script is, and then they go, you know, we ended up writing you out of the script. We're sorry. First year I did Deadwood was season two. I did half the shows. I did six of the shows. And season three, I did three shows. I did the last, episodes 9, 10, and 11 I did on Deadwood. And Deadwood was one of those cases where every week they said, you're on this week, get ready to go, you're on this week. And then, sorry, you'll be on next week. So it's a little tension-provoking, too. To have a recurring role.
Yeah. But you also were featured in two episodes of, again, I actually, there are certain shows that I really enjoy. Seinfeld was one of them.
Yeah.
Another one is Curb Your Enthusiasm. Another one's Desperate Housewives. And you were on both those shows as well.
Yeah. Probably your audience knows this, but on Curb Your Enthusiasm, there is no script. And I'm here to tell you, there is no script. In fact, Larry David, who also, created Seinfeld, he was the executive producer of Seinfeld. Again, you look at those executive producers. He does not even let you rehearse by saying words. When you get up there, he says, okay, we're going to have a political fight. You're going to be a conservative. I'm going to be liberal. We're going to have a fight. But for rehearsal now, let's just do blah, blah, blah. Because he doesn't want anybody to even open their mouth until the camera's rolling. So it is, you are hanging in the breeze on Curb Your Enthusiasm, and so you shoot it, and if it works, they do a variation of it. If it doesn't work, they do it again, and they do it a different way. And it's amazing that it even gets made. Larry knows the plot. he's got a page of plot points he goes by. But other than that, you just are kind of winging it.
Now, what was Len Dunkel's role on the show?
I played Jeff's brother-in-law.
Oh, okay.
You know, and I had come in from out of town, and I was a Republican that had come to the Seder Festival at Larry's house. It was the worst Seder in the world. You had the neighborhood sex offender there. You had me getting into political arguments with Larry all the time. There was nothing but a series of fights the whole time. The show was hilarious, by the way. It came out very funny. But that, again, that whole cast and crew, they were so terrific. I mean, partly because of the type of person you have to be able to just swing with it as they do.
Oh, yeah, it's an amazing job, and it's so, you're right, it's spontaneous because it has to be.
It has to be.
Yeah. Now, tell me a little bit about Desperate Housewives. What was your role there, and who did you interact with on the set?
I didn't know what to expect. They gave me a call. I was working on another show at the time, and I had one day off on this other show, and I got a call saying Desperate Housewives wants you to come in and work just this one day, your off day. And I said, great. So I called up. The costume people said, listen, we're awfully busy with the ladies. Can you wear your own clothes? And I said, no. I said, I don't wear my own clothes on a TV show. I don't know what the set looks like. I don't know what other people are wearing. I haven't even read a script.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what I'm playing. And they said, well, what did you audition with? And I said, I didn't audition. They just asked me to do this part. Then I call hair and makeup, and I said, well, listen, I'm looking kind of grungy because of Deadwood. I have kind of a little beard, and my hair's all grungy. I'll probably need, makeup, or you want to shave the beard or whatever. And they go, no, we don't have time. We're busy with the ladies. You're going to have to maybe do your own makeup. And I said, I don't do my own makeup. I don't. I said, listen, it's your show. If you don't want me wearing clothes, if you don't want me in makeup, that's fine. No problemo. Well, this was my introduction to that show. I got on the set. It was princely. Like, the ladies were wonderful. There was, like, no prima donnas, no divas. They were all absolutely hilarious to work with. They were delightful. They were, you know, they give you their little chair to sit down on if you needed to. The director, the producers, we all had a ton of fun doing the scene. I mean, it's one of those shows that everybody is trying so hard to be serious and not to laugh because
mm-hmm.
we're all having so much fun.
I enjoy watching it. What was your role on the show? What was Bud?
Well, I guess Carrie Hatcher's house burned down, and she wanted to collect on the insurance. And they wanted me to come in to be the insurance adjuster. And basically, I have to tell her that the house kind of burned down under suspicious circumstances.
I saw that episode, and now I recognize you from that episode. That's right. Now, is that going to be something that you'll be following up, since they're going to have to follow that up?
Well, that's going to be interesting. So when you do something like this, they always kind of imply that you're going to be coming back and doing that. But they don't want to imply it so much as to put you under contract. So, you know, we'll see. If it happens, I'll be thrilled. And if it doesn't, I'll do something else.
The thing is that if you look at it, and if you watch the show, which I do,
uh-huh.
that particular episode and the particular thing that happened is arson took place, and she's trying to cover up for it. The investigator, who was you, came in to mention it. So I would assume that they would have to deal with the investigator again, unless they just do it off camera.
Yeah, well, you know, they do that. You know, I always would think, in terms of human logic, that they would do that. But then when you saw what they did with Darren and Bewitched, I mean, they just switched Darren's out and, like, nobody cared. Or, like, Dallas, it was all a dream. You know, there's no way of imagining TV kind of logic.
Mm. Yeah, talk about logic or lack of it, but hilarity. Stephen Tobolowsky's birthday party, which is on DVD, and it's available right now from Monster Releasing. It's hilarious. And one of the stories you tell in it, there's a couple of them that really, they're not funny, but they're hilarious when you tell them about being held hostage But one of the funniest things is when you were nominated as one of the 100 coolest people in L.A. And you did all this work to try to, you know, prove yourself as being cool, and then lost the honor to Andy Dick. I just thought that was I almost threw up my drink. It was just so funny. I almost came out of my nose when I was watching that scene.
You know, people have seen the movie, and a lot respond. You know, they gravitate toward different people gravitate toward different stories, and different people have said that they've almost done a spit take laughing at certain stories, different ones in, mm-hmm. in the story, and they said, that can't be true, is it? It can't be real. And the thing I try to point out is that the one thing that Robert Brinkman, who directed that movie, and myself, the one thing we had that we were going to go with is that every story is absolutely true and happened to me. And that's, in a way, what makes the story so funny. Because the human ear can hear when something is like made up or phony baloney, but these stories are so weird, like being held hostage at gunpoint, and you know, what do you do when a guy's got a 45 stuck in your head, and you know, you have no practice as to how to talk this guy down. You're in a grocery store, and you know, I was talking and talking and talking to the guy, and the only thing at the time I could think of to do to keep the guy from killing me was to invite him over for dinner. And, you know, you would think, like, why, you know, and for the life of me, I couldn't even think of a phony address to give him. So here he is, he's got a gun pointed in my head, he's tearing off a bit of the brown paper bag that my vegetables are in, my fruit, my mangoes are in, and he's handing me a pen with his free hand to write down my address so he could come over and continue talking to me with this gun in my, you know, it is absolutely true. One thing the guys, the producer and Robert, tried to do, at the end of the film, there's that lovely kind of retrospective kind of a crawl of real photographs to verify the stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they went to the sheriff's department in Dallas, Texas, where that happened, where I was held hostage at gunpoint. And unfortunately, there was a flood in 1981 that destroyed all the records of that event. So we weren't able to get the police report of that event for the end of the movie. But all the stories are true about, you know, there's a 50% smattering of stories from movies and stories from my life. I happen to think life stories are more interesting than movie stories, but Robert Brinkman, our director, loves movie stories. I think generally human stories are more universal than like what happens on a movie set. And I think it's laughter of recognition is the key to any kind of comedy. So we premiered this movie at the Aspen Comedy Festival, HBO's Aspen Comedy Festival, last year, and it was well received. And since then, it has been all over the world. We just finished doing some shows in London, in Buenos Aires about 2 weeks ago, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Philadelphia. We've been all over, and everywhere we show the movie, the audience laughs, they cry, there are great responses to it. So we have decided, you know, to make the DVD available until we're in the malls, until we're at the store. So we have two sites where people can actually get the movie now and see the movie if they are so inclined. One is birthdaypartymovie.com, birthdaypartymovie.com, and the other is on good old Amazon.com. And both of those places you can get the movie, and it's called Stephen Tobolowsky's Birthday Party.
Well, what we're going to do is actually put a link up to that birthdaypartymovie.com site with the interview.
Great.
Some of the things I thought are very interesting about your life that people out there may not know, and we can just shortly talk about that for a minute or two here.
Yeah.
One, that you actually played Principal Flutie in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer pilot episode that never aired.
Right.
What a kind of a bummer that is.
Well, no, it wasn't really a bummer. Of course, I don't know, maybe it was a bummer, but I was actually under contract to another show at ABC.
Oh, okay.
Called Blue Skies, and Joss called me in to do the principal, and I did the principal. It was the first episode, and we had a good time. Maybe, you know, who knows, maybe it didn't turn out well, but I thought it did. But I was under contract, and everybody kind of knew it all along. So I was really unavailable to do any more of Buffy. But who knows, you know, maybe I stunk up the joint too, and I wouldn't have been available anyway.
Well, you were doing another show on ABC that I never heard of.
Yeah, Blue Skies.
Right, that one I never heard of. But I understand that you turned down the role of Al on a show I did hear of called Home Improvement.
Yeah, now, you know, are you ready for the true Hollywood story on this?
Hold on. The true Hollywood story. Go ahead.
Because Tim Allen was on the true Hollywood story the other night, and they were dissing me. They were dissing me because I didn't do Home Improvements. What happened was the creators asked if I would do Al on the show. My wife was pregnant at the time with our first child, and they were offering me $16,000 to do the pilot episode. And they said, we do not know if the pilot is going to go as a mid-season replacement, which it was. It aired right after the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's going to go next fall, a year from now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're not exactly sure where we're going to shoot. We don't know how many shows we're going to do. And they tied me down to an obligation where I couldn't work on any other show. So I said, you know, if we're doing, you know, a season of shows, $16,000 a show, I'll do it. I said, but my wife's going to have a baby. To say that I can't work for an entire year and just collect the $16,000 for a year, we'll starve. I have to be able to work, so I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Then they came back and they said, well, we'll let you do the movie you're working on now, which I believe was Single White Female. We'll let you finish that movie. You can do that, and then you have to be held. I said, well, you have no control over me doing Single White Female because I'm already under contract to them. The issue is, if you don't do a show for a year, I have to be able to work within that year. And they would not budge on allowing me to work for the year. So I said, I would love to do it. I'm dying to do it. I can't do it. I can't take the chance that the show won't go in a year. We're going to have a baby. And in fact, We had our baby that summer, and it turned out to be a mid-season replacement. So I would have ended up making millions of dollars on that show, yet at the same time, I would not have had my film career. I wouldn't have done Groundhog's Day. I wouldn't have done Sneakers. I wouldn't have done all the other shows I've done.
Mm.
So it would have been a ton of money, and it would have been being an icon on Home Improvements, but that would have been it.
And you could have ended up doing shows like Family Feud.
I could do Family Feud and play golf in the tournaments like Richard does.
Exactly.
I am going to see Tim in a week because I am going to be co-starring in his new movie, Wild Hogs, in Santa Fe. So it'll be interesting if it ever comes out as to what really happened.
Well, it'll certainly come out of his mouth, some comment to you, I'm sure.
Because, you know, on the TV show True Hollywood Story, Tim was going like, yeah, they tell me they got this actor here. You know, he's really funny and he's going to do this. But, hey, the guy can't show up to work. You know, to hell with him. You know, let's go with Richard. And I'm going like, well, wasn't a matter that I couldn't show up to work.
Yeah.
You know, that wasn't
There's a big story behind it. But that'll be interesting to find out if he actually knew the story.
Yeah.
And was just giving you crap.
Yeah.
you know, you were talking about your hostage situation in Snyder Plaza there. But the other thing I thought was very interesting was that you were almost murdered twice in a week in Hartford. Tell me a little bit about that. By different people yet.
Yeah, this was on the cool list. You know, Buzz Magazine nominated me as one of the 100 coolest people in Los Angeles, but they had no idea who I was or if I'd done anything that merited being considered cool. And could I please send them a list of what I had possibly done that was considered cool. So, I mean, how do you put together a list of what's cool? So I was thinking, you know, besides being held hostage at gunpoint, which is kind of cool, I mean, I survived it. But another thing in Hartford, Connecticut, twice in 1 week, unlike it was either on a Tuesday and a Thursday or on a Monday and a Wednesday, there was one interview, I was almost murdered twice in 1 week. I was doing the show The Wake of Jamie Foster at Hartford Rep, and on the way home, we would stop off. The street's name was appropriately called The Asylum. We stopped off at the asylum to have a drink, and some drunken man jumped on my girlfriend in the bar, and I pushed him away from her, and he pulled out a gun, and I started to leave the bar, and he stuck the gun into the back of my head. You notice this is a recurrent theme.
Yes, I noticed that. Your head is attracting guns.
And he says, turn around, and then he said some vile words, turn around, it's payday, and he said some more vile words. I ran outside and ran around the bar, and it confused him, because he came out, and he was looking for me, and I ended up avoiding him. 2 days later, I was at a pizza parlor on the same street, and I held the door open for three people coming into the pizza parlor, two men and a woman. But the door opened in instead of out. So my arm ended up going across the door as I was trying to, but it was obvious I was holding the door open.
Mm-hmm.
The guy says, you trying to bar our way? And then he said some horrible words to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, sir. You trying to disrespect my lady? I go, no, sir, not at all. Just trying to hold the door open. He pulled out a knife and stuck it in my stomach. I had my overcoat on, and my belt was across my stomach, and the knife went into the belt of my overcoat. And I said, please, just go in, sir, please. And so he, since he had not killed me yet, he went in, and we both walked away from it, and I decided then and there I would stay away from that street on the way home from the theater.
That sounds like a very good idea. You know, talking about cool, though, I thought one of the coolest things about you was that you were actually a lead singer in the first band that Stevie Ray Vaughan was in.
Okay, let's not make this grander than it is. Let's be truthful now. I was a singer, not a lead singer, but we were in this group called A Cast of Thousands. We were so bad. We played we played at like a Mormon rock and roll parties is how bad we were. So anyway, Bobby Foreman, who was the lead singer and lead guitarist of the group, said, we have a new guitar player who's going to do the electric leads. His name is Stevie Ray Vaughan. He's really great.
Mm-hmm.
Stevie Ray was 14 years old. We were picked as one of the five top garage bands in Dallas at the time, which was, I believe, 1970, 69 or 70. And so there is an album, which happens to be the first recording ever of Stevie Ray Vaughan. He was 14. There is an album poster, which has a picture of me at the microphone with hair, Bobby Foreman, who our lead guitarist, who ended up playing for the New Christy Minstrels, I believe, and Stevie Ray Vaughan in the center, sitting on a metal folding chair, playing electric guitar leads like lightning. I mean, he was amazing.
Hmm. I'm going to mention one more thing, and then I'll let you go. I just want to remind folks that if you want to grab this thing, you can just follow the link on our site and go right over to birthdaypartymovie.com, and you will be entertained. I guarantee you that you will get entertained much more than it costs you to buy the DVD. That's a guarantee on my part.
Thank you.
The film True Stories, which, of course,
sir,
was David Byrne from Talking Heads. Tell us a little bit about how you guys developed a plot line for that movie.
Yeah, it was... I'm going to switch phones here right a second because this phone's beeping. Let me see. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, great. My girlfriend at the time was a playwright. In fact, she won a Pulitzer Prize. She was a very famous playwright, and David Byrne asked her, Beth Henley, if she would work on his movie, True Stories. She went over to his house and came back that evening and said, I have no idea what David Byrne is talking about. I said, maybe he should call you, because I always like that kind of weird movie thing.
Uh-huh.
David called me up, and I went over to his house, and there was, like, no furniture in his house. The guy was like a minimalist.
Uh-huh.
And on the wall were about 200 pencil drawings. He's a graphic artist. He went to the Rhode Island School of Design. And he says, do you think we can make a movie out of these drawings? And also, I have written one song that's going to be in the movie called Wild, Wild Life. So this much I know for sure. And I know I want to call it True Stories. So I looked at the pictures. We looked at them for about 2 hours, in silence. And then I said to David, I said, I'll tell you what, I will go home and work on this. If I come up with anything you like, you could hire me. If it's something, nothing you like, don't worry about it. That night I went home and wrote a 35-page treatment. And I am from Texas, which is really big on, you know, the state fair and history and all that stuff. I said, what happens if we have a sesquicentennial, 150 years, a centennial, and that gives us an excuse to have all of these people come to town and do all of this stuff. We can have fashion shows, we can have computer experts, we can have exhibits. It brings together all of these disparate forces into this movie, into this one movie. And he liked that idea. And so I think he hired Beth and me to write the screenplay in 19 days.
Huh.
And for those of you who don't know anything about movies, Phil Robinson wrote Sneakers, the movie Sneakers, in 9 years. So we had 19 days to write this movie. We wrote it, and I think maybe 5 or 6 lines that we wrote actually ended up in the movie. David rewrote the movie and retooled it, but the basic idea was the one that David and I created, of a small Texas town with everybody coming together.
20 years ago, by the way, that film came out, which is hard to believe that it was that long ago.
And the songs are still good.
Oh, yeah. Well, Talking Heads definitely holds up in time.
Yeah.
And all his music. And how is Ann doing?
Ann?
Yeah. Isn't your wife named Ann?
My wife is named Ann. I'm just so surprised. I was wondering, like, hey, where do you know Ann from? She is doing so well. She's out riding a big old horse today.
There you go.
She's become a total horse person, and so she's out at the barn brushing the horses up and riding them up and riding in horse shows. She loves it. She's crazy about it.
Well, all folks who love horses, and I'm one of them, because I think horses are a really cool animal, are feeling a lot better now that the horse that was injured is doing much better.
Is he doing better?
Yeah, he is.
Oh, that made me cry.
Yeah, well, it made most of us have tears in our eyes, including the poor trainer and the rider. But the horse is doing pretty well, and it looks like he'll go out to stud, which is not a bad thing.
Not a bad life. That's kind of the life I've been relegated to.
Stephen Tobolowsky, you can get his DVD. Just go right to birthdaypartymovie.com. And it's been a pleasure talking to you, Stephen. And what are you working on coming up? You got anything new in TV or movies coming out?
I'm going off to Santa Fe to do Tim Allen's new movie.
Right.
Wild Hogs. I'm working on that. I'm supposed to do another film after that called Sex and Lies in Fresno. And it's kind of a drama, kind of gritty. And I play a fellow who believes in UFOs and wears like a tinfoil hat.
I can actually see you in that, Steve.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's a pleasure talking to you, and good luck with everything. And I hope the career continues at the high trajectory it has been for the last 30 years or 25 years.
Thank you, sir.
All right, take care.
You too, Mark.
Bye-bye.